On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we react to Tarek Skubal winning his historic arbitration hearing against the Detroit Tigers. $32 million is a lot of money, but not as much as $38 million, which is what Framber Valdez is going to be making with the Detroit Tigers. A huge contract for the left-hander as he joins Skubal in Detroit. We talk about all those moves, as well as the announcement of the World Baseball Classic rosters. What stands out? What did we learn from that announcement on Thursday? And then, of course, the good, the bad, the ugly. All that and more on this episode of Baseball Barbacast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world with the moxie to Venmo request Tarek Skubal. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And would he even notice?
That's a good question. I feel like we've asked players that we know this, just, you know, we see it even sometimes, players whose phone numbers we have, their Venmo activity. Venmo, one of the strangest social media apps we have. I have to imagine after this latest payday, Venmo is going to be below the Skubal, you know, regular transaction activity, which
he
is
just
probably
shows up
the best.
To your apartment with a literal sack of gold to pay you back. And that's because yesterday we got news that Tarek Skubal, the man, the myth, the ace, won his arbitration hearing against the Detroit Tigers. We're going to talk about why that's relevant, what that means moving forward for the sport and the Tigers and Paul Skeens, question mark. And of course, we'll do WBC stuff and then good, bad, ugla, because it is a Friday. We are in Buffalo, New York, because we went to the Sabres game yesterday. Did they win? Don't ask. Let's talk about Skubal. That's our opener.
Yes. If the Sabres had won, I would be wearing one of my many Sabres hats. But instead, I am representing one of the great WBC underdogs, Team Australia. But we're going to get to that later because we do have to talk about Tarek Skubal. He's not the only Tigers left-hander we're going to talk about today, as Framber Valdez is also a newly super rich man. But Tarek Skubal did it. Tarek Skubal and his army of Boris Corp agents. And did you see this note in Jeff Passan's story that Bruce Meyer himself was involved in the rebuttal to the negotiations? So I'll let you explain who Bruce is in a second. But again, the way that these arbitration hearings work is each side presents their case for how much, you know, money the player should be making. And then there's an additional round of rebuttals. So apparently Bruce Meyer, who you're going to explain who that is here in a second, was part, which again, I guess, yeah, you could bring in whoever you want to help with these things. And he is makes sense in this case to prepare and be part of the rebuttal to the Tigers case for why Tarek Skubal should only make $19 million. Whereas Team Skubal, Team Boris, Team MLBPA was arguing that Mr. Skubal should be making $32 million, which is notably a lot more than $19 million. And
true.
It turns out that the arbitrators decided, you know what? You're right. You should make $32 million.
So I think Bruce Meyer being there is really instructive of something. Bruce Meyer is the, I believe, chief counsel for the MLB Players Association, for the union. He's like the top lawyer, right? Tony Clark runs, he's the president. And then Bruce Meyer is effectively like the number 1B. And for him to be involved in the Skubal hearing tells you that this is not simply Detroit versus Skubal, this is league versus players. And that is true in part because of how arbitration hearings work. The league has a department called the Labor Relations Department that effectively helps teams set their arbitration filings. And so for Meyer to be involved in this is instructive that the union viewed this as something that was important for players moving forward. And it is not just a win for Skubal's wallet and his grandchildren who will get to go on nice vacations. It is a win for future players down the line.
I also think it's really important that framing of players versus league, because we're going to get into the Tigers element of this here because it's extremely important when it comes to talking about the other gigantic piece of Tigers news, their huge contract to sign Framber Valdez. But for all the people that want to, understandably, following this process, want to clown on the Tigers and be like, what were you thinking? How could you only offer him this? And I think there is some very legitimate, like, I don't think that's without merit whatsoever. However, this process is, as you mentioned, very much defined by precedent for the league. The league is not, they are the league and the labor relations department, they are the group that is telling the teams, you need to offer this based on how we have paid players in the past, comparables, whatever. My understanding, talking to people about this, the team is not like 100% mandatory, has to go with the recommendation of the league, but generally they're going to, right? And so while my understanding is that it is the Tigers' responsibility to provide someone to make the case against Tarek Skubal, and I think you can, that could be hiring an outside person, but the point is that is on the team to do that. The number that they get to before they even go to ARB, like, that is very much coming from above. This is not just Scott Harris looking at Tarek Skubal and being like, you deserve $19 million. And so I think that also helps inform how this whole process works because, as we mentioned, this is essentially the most important arbitration hearing in a long time for a lot of reasons. And yeah, you mentioned raising the bar. I can't even quite wrap my mind around how dramatically this is going to shake things up, right? There's also part of me that's like, well, we're about to have a new CBA and this whole system might be slightly different anyway. So I don't know how much I want to read into like what Brian Wu or Hunter Brown or some of these other guys is about to make in the future, let alone Paul Skeens. But it's just such a staggering jump up in precedent and a huge win for the players, no matter how you slice it.
My favorite nugget that we learned from the specific hearing itself is that Skubal did indeed, this was reported by Ken Rosenthal, I believe, Skubal did indeed bring his two Cy Youngs into the room with him, or he brought them to the area and yet did not bring them out during the hearing. This was something famously that Tim Lincecum did once during his arbitration hearing when he was a back-to-back Cy Young winner, and he brought them in or to the hearing and they settled during the hearing. But I think in a way this is even cooler, where it's like you have the two Cy Youngs for break in case of emergency and you don't even need them because you think that the hearing is going that well, right? That you don't even like call in the big dogs.
This line in Cody Stavenhagen's story at The Athletic is so funny, and it's just what you're describing. So again, he's referencing Tim Lincecum. He says, quote, as Tim Lincecum was said to have done in 2010, Skubal did not sit down and thud two Cy Young trophies on the table. He continues, Boris had the awards on hand in case things got heated. He did not break them out. So what does that mean? It's like, I mean, if you're using the Cy Young Awards, like, here's the thing. Having them, the kind of bravado of physically presenting them in such a case is great. I'm not disputing that. But it's not like the Cy Youngs weren't discussed. That's all they were discussing probably the whole time. So I just love the idea of, like, what does that mean? Well, I'm trying to think of the scenario. It's like, oh man, things get bad. You better show them, like, you really do have these things. Like, break them out, baby.
I think it would be a comfort for me, in a way, if I was Tarek Skubal, knowing that they're, like, if we're at DEF CON 2, I know I can go to DEF CON 1, right? That I know there's another level that, like, I can go to if I need it. And yet I'm not going to. There's power in that, right? There's purpose in that. And so again, we've never been in these rooms, freaking duh, but you're right. It is so funny that Boris is like, well, you know, you never know if you're going to need these. Never bring a silver slugger to a Cy Young fight, I guess is the moral of this story.
Yeah. Stay strapped. Anyway, so $32 million is a lot of money. And as I kind of referenced earlier, what it really means for the future of baseball players getting paid before free agency is something big. I don't think we really know, and we won't really know until a long time from now, right? Until these next versions. And certainly Skeens is going to be an interesting character there. However, now we have to kind of, is there anything else we want to say about Scobo? Oh, I mean, let's do Scobo. Okay. So we just mentioned that Scott Boras, you know, had these awards on hand just in case things got heated. But however he went about making his case, him and Bruce and, you know, the army of Boras Corps people.
Of quarter
zipped. This is the most obvious and really, I know Zach Gallen is still a free agent. This is the grand finale of this offseason Scobo. And it's a beautiful one because it is literally someone had to win and someone had to lose. And so here we go. It is now time for the Scobo. The Scott Boras scoreboard, Jake Mintz. And coming into today, Scott Boras on the offseason, again, giving him wins, losses, and draws for the anything that really happens with him during the winter. That includes getting a contract. That includes losing a client, adding a client. That includes making a bad pun. More on those in a second. Or, you know, what contracts are you signing? Are they good? Are they bad? Do we like them? Do we think your baseball player is happy? But this was perfect. Someone had to win and someone had to lose. And I think we have to start off by saying that a lot of people thought that this was going to be an L. Smart people who have been involved in arbitration looked at the situation and said, they have pushed this too far. I understand why they are attempting it, because you do have this special pitcher and this special circumstance. However, it is hard to believe that they would be able to win this. And yet, here we are, another victory, more money for a Scott Boras client. And so I understand that you would like to grade this in kind of a slightly different way than we normally have. So what are your thoughts on how we should apply the Scobo today?
One of the core tenets of the Scott Boras scoreboard is that every action, every happenstance is a singular win, loss, or draw. It is the same in sports. You win 15-0, it is the same as winning 1-0, right? Yet there is something about the magnitude of this particular event, given the definitiveness of the win, right? This is not ambiguous. He won. He literally won. And the size and the scale of it, the moxie to even attempt it, has me thinking, Jordan, about Portsmouth Football Club, a English soccer outfit in England that was in the Premier League when I started getting interested in the sport. And this happens to other teams in other leagues all the time, where if you like go bankrupt, or I think they call it going into administration over there, or you basically do like a big no-no, they'll dock you like 10 points in the league. Mm-hmm. They'll be like, you were so naughty that we're going to take 10 points away. And that has been stuck in my mind since I saw the Scobo result. Because Scott Boras did something so different here that I do think I am willing to give him 2 wins. Now, maybe that goes against what we have laid out, our Scobo constitution. And I'm willing to hear feedback from you and from our wonderful, delightful listeners. But that is what my heart is telling me.
I think all of these are fair points. I would point out that we have already given him a win for the attempt to begin with. When this first came out, okay, that he filed for $32 million, we gave him a win for that, right? We also gave him a win for some of his Scooble-related puns earlier in the offseason, like calling mm-hmm. him a saber-proof tiger, which was just
so good.
Exquisite. He had some other ones that were not quite as good. We're gonna get to that here in a little bit.
Can I make a pitch, actually? How do you feel about a win for the win and a win for bringing the Cy Youngs into the room and not using them?
But he had them in case things got heated.
in case they got heated. You never know.
Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to grant your motion here to give him two wins. However, okay. we have more to grade. So as I mentioned, he's been given a, like, Scooble, the name Tarek Scooble, the Cy Youngs, all these things have given Scott Boras a lot of content to make bad jokes about, with however you want to call it. And it is no surprise that after this ruling reached the public, several reporters reached out to Scott to be like, all right, let's hear it. You better have a line prepared for this, right?
I'm imagining Scott on the phone, like in front of a comedy bar brick wall with like the spotlight. But instead of a mic, he's like on the phone with Cody Stamenhagen.
So here we go. So this is in Cody's story. It says, reached by phone after Thursday's announcement, the agent offered one of his patented puns. Quote, when you're Psi squared, you're exponentially different. We all know that from Einstein. There's only 12 men to walk on the moon, and there's only 12 men to win back-to-back Cy Young Awards. Thoughts?
That's a loss because it's not Psi squared. It's not squared. It's just two.
Yeah, I mean, squared times it's a, yeah, I mean,
it's not Psi times Psi. He doesn't have a Psi times Psi number of Psi's. Right. He has two Psi's.
That's true. That's absolutely correct. I'm also confused by, like, squared Einstein, get it? And then being like, by the way, there's only 12 men to walk on the moon and 12 men to do this.
Not related at all. Not at all related. Einstein, not a moon, never went to the moon, Einstein.
Not a space guy.
Not a space guy. Helpful for space, but not specifically a space guy. The one thing I will say about this that is at least reassuring, Scott Boras, we did not know this before, believes in the moon landing. That's not bad. That's all.
Okay, that's fine, but we're not grading that. Here's what is, again, I agree with you, this is an L, but here's what really, like, hammers it down to be an L. And this, again, this gets at, like, the Boras performance that is so interesting. So that's in Cody's story, right? Which implies that Cody or someone at The Athletic working on this story called Scott, and he gave him this line. However, open up the Associated Press's story about this, okay? And what do you see? A quote from Scott Boras that is very similar but different. Quote, this was about Psi squared, Scooble's agent Scott Boras said in reference to Scooble winning Cy Young in both 24 and 25. Quote, it's an Einsteinian theory, kind of like MC squared. Scott, what do we... Stop talking.
Ugh.
Again... this is the thing. I don't know if this was like the first attempt. I don't know who he spoke to first. Maybe like the when he talked to Cody, that was like a second attempt, which in that case, it turned out better.
It did get better. Yeah.
That said, again, because this isn't a scrum. You know, he's sitting at his, he's on the phone. He's getting talked to all these different reporters. So he's getting to kind of use different line, the same version of a line multiple times, as opposed to when he's standing in front of everyone's microphone at the same time and giving the line and we're all hearing the same words. Look, so, yeah.
Who am I, Jordan, to critique and criticize and villainize a man for making the same joke to different audiences? That would feel hollow of me and unfair. However, I do appreciate your point that, like, the idea we can literally see him, like, working the joke out in real time over the phone with various reporters is one of the funniest things that I have ever seen. It's unbelievably hilarious. It is one loss. The pun is just one loss. Together, I'd like to give him two wins for bringing the Cy Youngs there and for, you know, obviously winning the hearing. That brings him to 18, 5, and 11. We'll have a couple more of these. When do you want to set the deadline? I think just opening day is our deadline.
Yeah, I think so. Again, like I mentioned Zach Gallen, we still got Max Scherzer. We still got Nick Martinez is a Boris guy, Michael Kopech, our pal Rhys Hoskins. Like he's got some other guys that can sign. But Gallen is going to be the big one for sure. We'll see how those other ones shake out. I think opening day is fine. I think that's a fine deadline.
Now, Tarek Skubal was not the only big nugget of news that happened with the Detroit Tigers this week, as Framber Valdez, on the night of the hearing before everyone knew the result, agreed to a 3-year, $115 million deal with the Detroit Tigers. This is significant for a multitude of reasons. The size of this contract on an annual basis is, frankly, preposterous. Okay, I'm not saying it's a bad deal. I'm not saying he's going to make them worse. Good for the Tigers. Great. They spent money. This is the highest their payroll's ever been. I think it's going to be at like $230-ish million. That's awesome. $38.33 million for Framber Valdez is the seventh largest outlay annually in the sport. It is the second largest for a pitcher behind only Zach Wheeler. And it is the largest ever for a lefty and the largest ever for a Latin American pitcher. He's an opt-out in there after year two. He entered the winter seeking, surely, a long-term deal, perhaps similar to the one that Dylan Cease got, 7 years, $210 million from the Blue Jays. And that never really materialized, it seemed, for Framber, whether that was because of his age. He turns 33 this upcoming November. He'll pitch this year at 32. Whether that was because he allegedly threw a baseball at his teammate, whether that is because he has a weird pitch mix, and he's, you know, peripherals took a half step back last year. For whatever the reason is, teams were not interested in Skubal on a long-term deal. He gets a pretty decent consolation prize, which is an outrageous amount of money on a very short-term 3-year deal.
You accidentally just said teams not interested in Skubal in a long-term deal, which is funny because I'm pretty sure they are. But to your point.
They are?
I would assume. I guess we don't know for sure yet. Well, stay tuned. We'll see how interested teams are in Tarek Skubal. If Tarek Skubal settles for a short-term contract, you can imagine that AAV is going to be higher than this one that Framber just set. However, that is important because you mentioned some of those like fun facts about the contract. And oftentimes when they're not, you know, agencies aren't getting what they're looking for, they kind of find creative ways to make contracts that still look sexy in the headlines, right? And this is a way to do that. And this is with it, by the way, opt out after the second year. So some amount of flexibility there. Now, you know, is Framber opting out, you know, at age 34, like, is that something? But whatever, at that point, he will have just been one of the highest paid pitchers for the last two seasons, and he's made plenty of money. And at some point, you got to sign, and you're at some, you don't have whatever. You wait this long, you're probably going to end up settling for something, and that's just the nature of the beast in free agency.
But this is a good settle. Like, this could have ended a way for Framber where it's a 2-year with an opt after year one. Having this deal is pretty strong.
I agree.
Pretty strong. Now, he'll re-hit the market at 35 with, I would imagine, like, he's not going to make a ton of money at that point. But whatever. Like, this is a really, really good deal for him.
Yeah.
Let's talk about it from the Tigers' perspective, though, because the timing here is perplexing to me. Like, is it a coincidence? Could it really be a coincidence that the Tigers agreed to this deal the night of the Skubal hearing? A moment that, as far as we understand it, defined their winter and kept them in a holding pattern to figure out what was going to happen with Skubal. And then until it didn't, like, they didn't know that they had lost that hearing when this news came out. I guess I'm a reporter, so like I should just go figure it out. But, like, I am so confused about that dynamic. And if someone smarter than me can explain it to me, that would be wonderful. including you.
I am too. I'm trying to figure it out too. I mean, to me, it's more of just like going back to the premise of them being in this holding pattern with their payroll or just trying to have some clarity about Scooble, which is just like, okay, but we all knew. I mean, they had added some pitching already, at least in the bullpen early on. And so if you were willing to get this aggressive, that's what's so strange about this, regardless of Scooble. If you were willing to do anything remotely resembling this, why didn't you do this a month ago? Like, is this the deal you were waiting to do? Like, that's what's so strange about it. Like, this feels like a weird compromise for a team like the Tigers, who in theory would make, but maybe they even, maybe everybody, not just teams like the Mets and Dodgers, would always rather have the shorter term deal and not want to saddle themselves with the longer term thing. And so, yes, they were waiting for Fromber's ask to come down from 5 years. Yeah. And then this is just happened to be when it came down. I think that is like the simplest answer. It is still a very bizarre way for this to end up going.
My biggest issue with this is that I don't think it makes the Tigers a World Series contender. And that's because their offense is still the weak spot. Even if they – like, look, Fromber makes them better, and rolling out Scooble and Fromber in a playoff series is awesome, and, like, that will win them a lot of games. Duh. I trusted this team's ability to prevent runs. They have done that in the playoffs very well, where it's like they're going to throw whoever the heck out there, and they're going to generally keep runs off the board. Now, Fromber's going to probably do a better job of that than bullpen chaos. I get it. But this offense is what needed a boost. This offense needed reinforcements. It needed a focal point. It needed a centerpiece. Because maybe Cary Carpenter is kind of that guy when he's cooking against righties. I don't think Riley Green is quite at that level. We had this conversation on the recent pod, right? Do you have a monster in your lineup? Do you have a player that can finish in the top three of MVP? Most teams that win a World Series have that player. And I do not think the Tigers have that player. And I would have liked to have seen them spend this money on an offensive piece, I think. In this, the final year of Scooble, probably likely. And so I commend ownership for pushing the payroll to this level, $233 million. That's good. But I don't know if it has been done in the most prudent and efficient manner. I don't look at this – like, do you look at this roster and you're like, that's a $233 million roster? Like, they're the – like, in some ways, yes. In some ways, no.
I mean – I definitely don't. I think that it's a very strange payroll because of where the money is invested, because now you just have these two gigantic contracts, one of which is obviously completely deserved in Scooble, one of which is a very, very, very awesome pitcher in Fromber Valdez, but isn't probably not worth $38 million, whatever. And then it's Javi Baez, and it's Jack Flaherty, and it's Gleyber Torres on his QO, which is a lot of money, and, like, Gleyber's fine. I mean, you say top three in MVP. They don't have – Riley Green finished 17th. I mean, they don't have anyone even, like, sniffing that, right? They don't have – I mean, yeah. Rafael Devers is better than anyone on this team. We were just talking about it in relation to the Giants. Giants have probably three or four guys that are closer to that than anything the Tigers have on the offensive side of things. So I agree with you. Now, who is that player that they should have signed? Is it a Bregman? Is it, you know, whatever? You know, we can debate that. But I agree with you. I think the real case for Fromber is less about October in a weird way, as much as how steady he's been in the regular season. And yeah, this is a team that's still trying to win the division, having come, you know, pretty close. I mean, man, oh man, did they come close and then just completely capitulate. So I think Fromber gives you a unique amount of stability and upside in the regular season in ways that not all starting pitchers do. And I have to imagine that's also part of the calculus. And I'll just finish with this before we take a break. I think that his incident with Cesar Salazar, like that whole thing was definitely sketchy and concerning. So I don't want to discount that. And I totally understand if there's people that look at that and are concerned. But straight up, like, I freaking love this pitcher, man. I mean, this is a guy who, just thinking about him now signing this contract, I mean, this is someone who I've enjoyed watching since he first kind of burst on the scene, really in 2020. And to see him become such an important, you know, one of the best left-handed pitchers in baseball. And he is coming off really his worst season since he's become a full-time starter. But even that, you know, he's given you 31 starts. He's keeping you in games. And he finished really poorly. And that's kind of what tanked his numbers. And that part of that was also when that incident happened, right at the end of the season when everything was kind of falling apart for Houston. So that the timing of that kind of makes sense. But he's just been one of my favorites to watch for a long time. And I'm glad that he did get a pretty, you know, headline grabbing deal, because he is a unique and very, very fun pitcher.
All right, let's take a break. And when we come back, we will crumble up Major League Baseball and we will throw it in the trash and we will adopt a worldwide view. We'll be right back. Now, usually on the show, we go around the league. Let's go around the world. Yesterday. Well, the two of us were at the Buffalo Sabres game. Full rosters for the World Baseball Classic were announced. What a lovely day to see graphics of guys in positions, to see the full list of names, whether that is superstars that we weren't expecting or guys that only Jordan Schusterman and the guy's parents have heard of. It is a wonderful day in the baseball calendar. And I think because of how these rosters kind of get announced over a long period of time, we've known most of the big stuff. Like you and I, like publicly, all but two of the names on Team USA were in there. A lot of the Dominican Republic team was in there. But to see it all in one spot is a reminder of like how stacked the top teams are. And it is also kind of a good opportunity to really look at what we learned yesterday. So let's begin there. And Team USA, as I mentioned, had all but two spots filled. And with those last two spots, I think we had a conversation that was like, who are those guys going to be? Right? It could be, because there are so many good players, it could be like really, really talented dudes at the top of their game. That's not necessarily what happened.
No.
Respectfully.
No, I mean, I think we knew, and honestly, I'm not shocked because we've already talked about this in terms of roster construction for the best teams. It probably is a good idea to have some role players. That is especially true on the mound in some respects, to have guys that, you know, we talked about Clayton Kershaw's involvement as the dude that's probably going to come in and throw the innings that are not important so that you can save guys' arms, which is all the more important when pitchers are on pitch count limits, when are trying to ramp up for the season. The pitching is so complicated, but I think it's also true on the position player side. I think when you look at how they have constructed this Team USA lineup, I think it's a lot of balance in terms of right left. And I think Paul Goldschmidt being the last position player is a little bit surprising just because he doesn't bring as much defensive versatility. Maybe I speculated we could have seen someone like Jake Cronenworth, but Ernie Clements got that covered. Ernie's going to be the one bouncing around. And so Goldschmidt gives them a lefty masher. I mean, all these hitters are awesome, right? But the Team USA in particular, like, it is really, really, really balanced. Like, at almost every position, you can kind of go right or left. And I think
you Goldschmidt, can imagine a
especially
scenario,
having been on the team last time, I'm not surprised that he got the invite back.
He's here because of the scenario where, like, late in a game, Harper's up. They go to a lefty out of the bullpen. Goldschmidt comes in for Harper, right? Or really any lefty on left mat. Even same thing with Schwarber late in the game. The other team goes to a lefty. You want to bring in the right. That's really why he's on the roster. And then Michael Wacha, the other guy, he's here to, like you said, throw some of those other innings. Now, Michael Wacha is still like a solid pitcher, right? No shame to him. But he's probably on the squad to throw the in-between innings. Go ahead.
Yeah, and that doesn't even necessarily mean lower leverage. I think length is the key, because the greatest mystery of the whole tournament, and we're going to keep talking about this all the way until the final, is just how much are the pitchers going to pitch? And so having guys that are going to be building up towards the starting pitching workload the way that Michael Wacha is, having an option of a pitcher that you can turn to that is not going to be like, a lot of these relievers at this point, it's not like their teams want them going out there and throwing 30 pitches or certainly throwing multiple innings. And so to have more options that you can go cover multiple innings is going to be really important, whether that's in a game that's really important or whether or not. So I am not shocked by these selections. And I think the other thing we're going to talk about Team USA plenty in the coming weeks, but Goldschmidt joins a very short list of players who were on the team last time. Team USA is one of the most different teams in the tournament compared to 2023. The only players returning are Goldschmidt, Bobby Witt Jr., Kyle Schwarber, Will Smith, and David Bednar is the only pitcher who was on the staff last time. So that is, and I think that's a theme with really the best teams, except for Japan, or a little bit less so with Japan. But Team DR, which we can talk about here a little bit, is also ridiculously loaded and ridiculously different. I mean, yeah, they had some big guys play last time. They had, you know, Julio and Soto last time and Machado, but the depth of the lineup and the pitching in general is so much better than it was in 2023.
So that is part of it. The other thing about the Dominican team that I like that is different is that the bench bats are bench bats. Like, the utility guys are utility guys. Everyone is on this roster for a reason. And it's not just, let's try and cram as much possible talent on here as we can. And that was, as far as we understand, like, maybe one of the problems with the team last time is, like, everyone thought they were playing and they didn't get out of the group stage. Like, that was like a disaster. Because when you look at the bench, I know I'm the only person in the world that's like, hey, look at the Dominicans bench, you know? But the bench is Amed Rosario and, you know, Johan Rojas and Carlos Santana. Guys who understand that they're not going to start and are there to play a very specific role. And I think that that is an interesting pivot and pretty different than how they built this roster last time. And I think that will help them in this edition of the tournament. Let's do Venezuela, because I think their pitching staff was a big takeaway for you.
Yeah, I just think, you know, talking to our good pal Daniel Alvarez, who obviously is as plugged in with this team as any, I know he expressed some concern about the pitching coming into just getting ready for this tournament. And yeah, I mean, there's definitely some guys that are missing. You know, they don't have Lizardo like they did last time, you know, Martin Perez. But I don't know, I still see, like, you know, you add a Cater Montero. He's someone who's like a good big league pitcher. Jose Buto, I think, is a solid big league pitcher. Bizardo, of course, is a really good major league reliever. And then Ranger Suarez is like the ace who, you know, Suarez is definitely better than Jesus Lizardo. But like, that is essentially a one for one in terms of just like upside that they now don't have from last year. But yeah, I mean, Ranger Suarez, who knows how much he's actually going to pitch, as we'll keep repeating. But Daniel Palencia, another one who's like a real impact reliever. So it's not quite as deep as some of the other top teams. Venezuela, to me, is kind of in their own tier below DR, USA, Japan, but above pretty much everybody else. Because while they did not, you know, get Altuve and maybe they're missing a couple. I mean, this lineup is also still freaking awesome. I mean, the outfield alone of Acuna, Willy Abreu, Jackson Churio is so much fun. They ended up getting a rise. Mikel Garcia, a huge breakout. Like, both Contreras brothers, Sal Perez. Like, this team should still absolutely be in the mix here. It's just going to be really going to come down to that's going to be a team that, like, their starters are going to really have to show up, because if they have to start stretching that pitching staff, it is going to get a little dicier.
They're better without Altuve on the roster, I think, as sad as that sounds. Maybe that's nuts. You know, I would prefer he's in the tournament. He's a legend. But like Andrés Giménez at second can go, he can pick it. Like he's really good player and a good player to have in a tournament setting. The other main takeaway I have when you look at all these rosters is just how much top tier starting pitching there is compared to previous seasons. So you can make a pretty good argument that like four of the five best pitchers in the world are doing the WBC. Okay. Skubal, yes. Skeens, yes. Yamamoto, yes. Christopher Sanchez, yes. I mean, that's the 1, 2, and 3 in the NL Cy Young last year. And that's the AL Cy Young winner. The Crochet is the one who's not doing it, right? That's a significant change from previous seasons. When you look at the offensive talent that's going to be in the tournament, it is sexy to look at those lineups stacked together. But we have seen that before. Not maybe quite on this level, but we've seen awesome lineups before. We have never seen this quality and quantity of starting pitching in the WBC ever. And so for all of the concern about insurance and whether the tournament is in a bad place, to me, this is a sign that people want to do this, right? That people want to go and participate, particularly for someone like Skubal, who has so much freaking money on the line this year. For him to opt into this is just like so badass. And I hope that the starting pitching being better than in previous years will make the tournament more interesting when it's like, and less of a blowout. If like, I think in pool play that will happen. So that is just something that struck me. And, you know, I put together a sheet, Jordan, which is admittedly an unscientific way to do this, right? How many of the MLB Network top 100 players are in the WBC, right? Every year MLB Network does its top 100 players. It's certainly not perfect. It's a good snapshot though. And this year, this edition, 40 of the top 100 are playing, which is the most that there's ever been since MLB Network started doing this in 2013. 9 of the top 10 players are participating in the WBC. Otani, Judge, Witt, Raleigh, Soto, Skeens, Skubal, Corbin Carroll, Vlad Guerrero. 16 of the top 20. Like, the talent is there, and that has me super excited about the tournament.
Yeah, that's a great way to look at it. I think, and listen, I mean, every roster's got something that is you know, catches your attention. I'll have a little bit of more WBC love in my ugly later. Two more teams I just want to hit on before we take a break. The first is Puerto Rico, right? So this was, of course, a team we have been talking about recently because of all of the issues involving players getting insured. If you want to go back and listen to our conversation, read Jake's reporting on that. I encourage you to do that. Ultimately, it did end up being essentially worst case scenario, which is that Francisco Lindor and Carlos Correa are not on the team. I think that is hugely disappointing, for sure. I think that looking at the roster and wondering, Puerto Rico is very unique because it is at the top, you know, as good as any, because you have players like Lindor and Correa and Edwin Diaz, but because it's just a much smaller country, the depth is just not quite as much there. That said, because of the pool that they're in, that they're hosting, which is, I think, easily the most balanced of our four pools, I look at their roster and I still think they got a decent, like, again, it's hugely disappointing that they don't have Lindor and Correa. And I don't want to like just move that aside. And I totally understand people being really pissed about that and having a lot of questions about it. But I mean, they still got a good number of big leaguers, and it's not, certainly on offense, it's not quite the same level, but you know, I think a lot of people will still be rooting for them for sure, just to kind of overcome this weird handicap that they've had to deal with. So certainly disappointing, but they got, you know, hey, Nolan Arenado's playing for the first time. I think he's one of, I think just like the fifth player ever to play for multiple countries. He's been on Team USA in the past. He's got, I think on his mom's side, Puerto Rican heritage. So,
okay. Maybe this is a grumpy take. It's cool. I like that he could do that. feels like you should have to pick, though. Right? Like in FIFA, you got to pick. You can't go back and forth, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe he can't go back to USA. Like, if Nolan Arenado, like, you know, catches fire, like, has a 2020.
I mean, that's the thing, right? These situations WBC, are only... Like, there's a reason if he was still in his peak, you know, he's not playing for Puerto Rico. It's not that complicated, but
sure. He
wants to find his way back in the tournament, and that's great. I love that.
Cool.
So we'll see how that one shakes out. And then I think the last team we have to, do you have anything else on Puerto Rico? Cause we have to talk about it. We have to talk about Italy.
Yeah. We should probably talk about Javi Baez. Javi Baez.
Okay. Yeah.
We'll do it here.
Yeah.
Not on the roster. Yeah. Because he was smoking the bowl. I mean, maybe. Anyway, he tested positive for cannabis in during the 2023 tournament. Now, marijuana, weed, whatever, is legal in Major League Baseball and in many states across the country. That is a relatively new thing in the last, 5 to 10 years. I have many thoughts on the process of that, about like John Singleton and whatever. It is not allowed within the like international baseball rules. It is a banned substance. And so when Javi Baez peed in a cup during the 2023 tournament to make sure he wasn't taking steroids, I would imagine he tested positive for weed. And because it comes with a 2-year sentence that wasn't started until 2024, which doesn't make sense, he cannot play. Like, he is suspended for this tournament. This does not affect his eligibility with the Tigers. Like, he's going to camp. He's fine. This is preposterous. This is ridiculous. There's no way that Javi knew it was against the International Baseball Federation's rules when he did this. Maybe he should, I guess. But he did break the rule. Like, he broke the rule that existed. We understand that the league tried to like smooth this over, couldn't get that done. And I think it's more of a bummer because it's like, if Puerto Rico had Lindor and Correa, it's like, okay, whatever, Javi Baez, was smoking weed and can't play. But he would have been the headliner of this team had he been eligible. Maybe not on a talent perspective, but he's certainly one of the most visible players on the team. And so it is kind of a bummer that he's not going to be able to participate. And as a guy who gave us one of the most indelible, unforgettable moments in the history of the WBC, which was the no-look tag in 2017, like, this is a guy I want to have around this tournament, and it's a bummer he's not in it.
Yeah, no notes there. That is a unfortunate sequence of events. Let's talk about Team Italy quickly before we take a break. This was, I think, the team I was most excited to see the roster, because knowing that because of the loose rules involving eligibility, that Team Italy was going to be able to likely recruit many a player with Italian heritage. Yeah.
Well, so this is a good time to just talk about this. We have not mentioned this explicitly. The eligibility rules for the World Baseball Classic are as follows. You can play for a country if you are eligible for citizenship in that country. You do not need to be a citizen of that country. That is different than the Olympics, which is going to be interesting if we have big leaguers in the Olympics at some point, the next Olympic cycle. For the Olympics, you need to be a citizen of the country, I'm pretty sure. WBC, not the case. So if you have one Italian grandparent or one Dominican grandparent, in the case of Austin Wells, you can play in the WBC. The Israel team is 99% American Jews who are not citizens, right? And so that is why you have these scenarios where you look at the Italian roster and you're like, this is mostly just Italian American guys, which is fine. It's cool. This is how the tournament, like, it's great. Italy then becomes this fascinating team that is far better than it has been in the past and like emerges as a legitimate dark horse to go pretty deep in this thing, because the lineup and the pitching are probably better than we expected.
Yeah, and I don't want to go player for player right now, but the main point and part of why I was so excited about this is from a logistical standpoint, I was also quite confident they were going to be able to put together a better team because their pool play is in Houston this year instead of in Taiwan. So in 2023, if you were going to commit to Team Italy, that was quite the haul that you were going to then, you know, have to make all the way over to the other side of the world. And so, yes, Vinny Pasquantino and Sal Frelick and Miles Mastroboni and Nicky Lopez and a couple pitchers in the big leagues like Andre Pallante and Matt Festa. And, you know, they had some guys last time. They put together a pretty good roster, all things considered. This year, again, we'll do the specifics when we really delve into the nitty-gritty preview stuff as the tournament approaches. If you just go by players in MLB organizations right now, okay, MLB has a great post up right now, which is like everybody from every team at any level that is in affiliated ball from every country. And Italy, from what I can tell, is third of all teams behind U.S., Venezuela, I guess fourth, and DR for players in affiliated baseball on their 30-man roster. That is ahead of Mexico.
Oh, yeah.
That is ahead of Canada. That is ahead of Israel, which, as you mentioned, is just a bunch of American Jews, like ahead of Puerto Rico. I mean, this is a real group that especially, I mean, they got a challenge with USA and Mexico in their pool, but this is a real team.
How many teams have nine big leaguers in the starting lineup? USA, DR, Venezuela, Italy. Depending on your thoughts of like the Urias brothers and Rowdy Tellez, maybe Mexico. But like Italy, it's a real group, dude. And showing up to this tournament with that many big leaguers is a difference maker. And having someone like Aaron Nola pitching for them is the biggest difference compared to previous years. Like, Aaron Nola is the most accomplished pitcher to ever play for Team Italy in the WBC. Like, I would imagine by a lot. And he gives them a really interesting, you know, shot to go deep in this thing.
Yeah.
Anything else before we, I mean, there's so much on here, right? Like, there's so much fun stuff, like, on some of these smaller teams, like, the worst teams. Like, we could talk about it for hours, and we did last night, because we're in the same place.
And we will for the next month.
And we will for the next month.
So this is far from over, but we will take a quick break. And guess what? I got more WBC for you in the good, the bad, the ugly coming up after this break.
Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. It is time for the good, the bad, and the ugly. One thing good, one thing bad, and one thing odd, bizarre, wonky, thought-provoking from the week that was. Jordan Schusterman, get us started.
It's going to be pretty straightforward. For my good, I'm going to do Miguel Andujar, who signed with the San Diego Padres for 1 year, $4 million with incentives. And I just really like Miguel Andujar. And I'm glad that he got a job on a team that definitely needs offense. And I don't know why he couldn't. I mean, I understand he's not a great defender and, you know, some pretty severe platoon splits. But this past year, he hit righties pretty well. I just am fascinated by his career arc. And I'm glad that he has rallied to get some more guaranteed money in Major League Baseball. For how marvelous that rookie season was in 2018. He plays 149 games in 2018. This past year, when he played 94, was a new high since then. Major League games played since 2018, 12, 21, 45, 36, 30, 75, 94. So all these years later, he is showing that, no, I actually can hit. And the San Diego Padres agree. Here's a very lazy, basic fun fact for how good Miguel Andujar was last year. Minimum 300 plate appearances. Second in batting average in Major League Baseball behind his old pal, Aaron Judge. So he's not making quite Aaron Judge money like maybe, you know, in 2018 we were like, oh, these two guys are just going to be superstars together. But he goes to the San Diego Padres, and I like that move. Also in Padres news, just want to mention this. This probably deserves a longer conversation, but it sure sounds like the Padres are getting sold. Some real reporting we've got from Sportico, from Dennis Lynn, that the Seidler family is, as they basically told us earlier this offseason, like, we're looking to kind of move on here. And whether this ends up being good, bad, or ugly, I think remains to be seen. But some of the super rich people involved in this process, a process that appears to be, like, coming to a head here, like, it sounds like we're going to have a resolution. Hopefully this isn't a Twins fake-out situation. I think that I have to imagine Padres fans right now, if they're looking at their ownership group and realizing that the current Seidlers are not necessarily going to be as aggressively passionate about adding baseball players as the late Peter Seidler, that maybe you would rather see what's behind door number two and take another super rich person that wants to take over the Padres. So there's always some risk when we talk about new owners in that sense. But I do think that this is going to be a very interesting one to monitor for a million reasons. I mean, the Padres are always fascinating. So we will keep an eye on that and talk about it more at length when more news comes.
I have an idea. Tarek Skubal, give him an ownership stake this offseason.
Ooh. That's like what Ronaldo does, right? That's like what they do in soccer. Don't just like Messi's like...
That is like what they do.
Messi... Yeah. Messi, like, oh, you get like half of our TV revenue for MLS or whatever. I mean, I'm sure I'm making stuff up right now, but I think that's like sort of a real thing where they're like, hey, Messi, come play in Miami and you can just take half of our revenue for the league. Yeah, I like that idea. Right. And yeah, the Padres are certainly going to need pitching. So make it happen.
My good this week could have been an ugla. It was an ugla week here in the world of baseball.
It was.
Jeff Passan reporting yesterday that the Texas Rangers have agreed to a contract with right-handed submarine pitcher Josh Hejka, minor league deal. Now, who is Josh Hejka? Certainly not someone that most of you have heard of. It is someone that we have known for a long time. Josh Hejka was a Division III pitcher, frankly, a Division III icon at Johns Hopkins University. And Josh Hejka is not just a submariner or a sidearmer. He is one of the weirder pitchers that I have ever seen throw. And yet Josh Hejka, who has been around the block, went out this winter and he said, you know what? I need to get even weirder. And he spent the winter dropping his arm slot as low as he possibly can to like throw basically like up. He's trying to do the Rodgers, like Tyler Rodgers, like throwing up. Even now, what was good about this week is, why is Jeff Passan, the premier newsbreaker in our industry, reporting on a minor league deal between a bespectacled submariner with zero big league time and the Texas Rangers? The answer is because last year, when Josh Hejka was traded for cash considerations from the Mets to the Phillies, he himself tweeted, can't believe at Jeff Passan wasn't on the Hejka for a bag of balls trade first SMH. This time, Passan doesn't miss out, and he gets the Hejka scoop. That is good. It is good that like a D3 dude that we've known forever has like gotten to this point where his signing is being broken by Jeff. It's so good.
And
I texted Josh and Jeff trying to confirm that I can get the scoop next year. I want the 2027 Hejka scoop. Jeff said he'll fight me for it.
Well, you're looking past what I'm thinking about, which is the Hejka call up.
Hejka call up scoop.
I mean, he's reached AAA. The Rangers is a nice fit for him to maybe end up in the big leagues. So, oh, I love that guy. That's awesome. That's so funny. And again, the funniest part, right, is that however many thousands of people that have Jeff Passan notifications on waiting for actual news, being like, oh, Josh Hejka.
Oh, it's just Hejka.
It's so funny. All right, let's go to bad. What a week for bad in the world, in baseball, in life, in this industry. So much bad nowadays. Now, we usually try to keep it on the field, but much to choose from. However, I'm going to go with Emmanuel Clase's latest developments, which, courtesy of some reporting from David Purdom at ESPN and Jeff Passan also involved in this, which is very funny because he's also reporting on Josh Hetchko. Anyway, last we heard from Emmanuel Clase slash whatever was going on with the Emmanuel Clase, Luis Ortiz, these guys were betting on their own pitches in Major League Baseball games. November, we had a indictment unsealed where we got the details about kind of what they were, prosecutors were alleging. And that initial indictment listed 9 games in which Emmanuel Clase was throwing rigged pitches. And then I believe 2 games in which his teammate Luis Ortiz on the Guardians, was throwing suspicious pitches that were then connected to bets that made nearly $500,000 from certain gamblers. The update to this story, which is bad, is that apparently it was a whole lot more than 9 games, as there has been additional information and allegations made that Clase has been accused of throwing suspicious pitches in at least 48 games, which is a whole lot more than 9, and most importantly, a whole lot more than 0, which is the number that it should be. And when you add that
everyone makes mistakes,
Yeah.
Rig a game once, on shame on me. You know?
Yeah.
Rig a game once, shame on you. Rig a game twice, shame on all of us.
So, two things
rig a game
here.
48
the other,
times.
I think, really interesting. The other interesting thing here, by the way, here from the story from David Purdom, quote, a record of the court proceeding states that Clase, quote, has identified at least 250 pitches on which bets were placed. Don't love that. Here's the thing. First of all, the more that this grows, the more it is just like amazing, if all of this is true, that Emmanuel Clase was tanking his own performance and one of the three best relievers in the sport for however long. Like, he was actively sabotaging himself in a large percentage of his own games and was still this good. The other important thing here, which is like actually really interesting and something that I have suspected for a while that is going to how this was going to trend, is that Luis Ortiz's attorney asked in this filing for his client's case to be severed from Clase's, arguing that Ortiz and Clase have, quote, markedly different levels of culpability and his client could not receive a fair trial otherwise. So the trial is currently set for May 4th. Whether we get there, who knows? But this is kind of based on, we don't necessarily have to review all the details right now, but when we got this first indictment, when this whole scheme was laid out, it was very clear based on the story that was told and narrative that was presented that Clase was leading the charge and kind of got Ortiz involved. That does not remove a level of, like, this does not mean Luis Ortiz is going to be the Guardians 3 starter this year. It just means that from a legal standpoint, I am not surprised that his legal team is like, hey, hold on a second.
Yeah.
What my dude got roped into is a whole lot different than whatever Emmanuel Clase was doing.
Yeah. The big problem here for me is that when this news broke, the line of frame, like the framing from Rob Manfred and MLB, was that our processes worked. Our methods of monitoring and catching these guys when they're cheating, whether that's suspicious betting on pitches or their accounts linked to certain people. Manfred was like, this worked. We caught him. That, as we learn more about the scale of this, rings hollower and hollower, because it clearly worked eventually. If your basement's flooding and you don't stop it for a month, it's still wet down there, you know? Like, just because they got him eventually doesn't mean that they succeeded in stopping the problem in the first place. And that's because the problem is just structural, right? It's betting has – sports betting has become this enormous thing, and there are always going to be enough stupid people that do unreasonable things to break the rules. Like, that's just humanity. And so I am interested to see how the league kind of responds to this case as it grows, if they respond at all. Do we see any changes? We've already seen some changes about these micro bets. That is a good thing. Do we see any more? It is just so bad. The whole thing is bad. And I really don't want to talk about it because it bums me out. But we have to because we're, you know, we do this for a living and we like to think we're good at our jobs. Speaking of things that bum me out, my bad this week. This is just so weird, too. This week could be ugly. This is a headline from the AP. MLB players strike deal to be turned into AI characters that can chat with fans. Reading from a story yesterday. Under an agreement announced Thursday between a company called Genies and the MLB Players Inc., the business affiliate of the Players Association, AI avatars of top stars will be created that can have conversations with fans. Each avatar will reflect a player's voice and interests. These Genies will have the ability to charge for chat interactions, in-app experiences, digital goods. The company cannot say which players will initially be available as stars. So is this like I pay this company $100 and I can have a conversation with AI Ohtani? Hey, Shohei, what happened with Ipe? Like, I'm sure this will end well. I'm sure this will end great. I'm sure this will go perfect.
Yes, this is so bad and so ugly. I can't even decide which it is more. This being an AP story that is, what, four sentences is so telling because it's like, this feels like things that people should know, but also like, what in the world are we even talking about?
And the Players Association.
Yeah.
The Players Association is not sending this to every reporter to be like, hey, you should write about this. This is cool, man.
Yeah. You know? But unfortunately, there's a reason they agreed to it. And it's because there's money in this terrifying, creepy, weird
thing,
probably problematic technology. So that's
I've already heard from works. Two players. I've already heard from two players who are like, what in the world is this? / what could go wrong? So
other than at all. Everything. All right, let's keep it ugly and finish off with another WBC fun fact. The great Sarah Langs delivering some wonderful fun facts and stats about the World Baseball Classic rosters. And the one I want to key in on is the oldest and youngest players in the tournament. Because on their own, these two fun facts are amazing. The first is that Alexi Ramirez, last seen in Major League Baseball in 2016, last seen in professional baseball in 2018, is on Team Cuba at age 44. He is the oldest player ever. Assuming he plays, he will break Roger Clemens' record for the oldest player in WBC history. Roger Clemens was 43 in 2006. Alexi Ramirez, Cuban shortstop, 44. But what I love is that the youngest player in the tournament is Joseph Contreras, a 17-year-old pitcher for Team Brazil, making their return to the WBC for the first time since 2013. Brazil is the only new team. This is the only new team in the tournament compared to 2023. They replaced China, effectively. And what I love is that Joseph Contreras is the son of Jose Contreras, who was Alexi Ramirez's teammate on the 2008 wow. White Sox. Now, Alexi Ramirez was not on the 05 White Sox, which is, of course, what Jose Contreras is known much more for. They're both Cuban, like from the same area, played for the same team in Cuba, like very close relationship between those two, even though they only crossed over with the White Sox for a year. But because Brazil's probably not making it out of pool play, we are unfortunately will not get to see Alexi Ramirez face Joseph Contreras. But I still love this. And also, Joseph Contreras is like a person to know because he could be a first-round pick this year out of a Georgia high school. He is a Vanderbilt commit, a very talented right-handed pitcher. And he is was born on May 6th, 2008, which I'm now realizing was a game I bet that was Alexi Ramirez's rookie season. And on May 6th, 2008, he had an off day. But he did play on May 7th, 2008 against the Minnesota Twins. So shouts out to Alexi Ramirez, the oldest, and Joseph Contreras, the youngest.
For me, the Ugla. One of my favorite Uglas in a while. A lot of the teams are coming out with their promotional schedules right now. A lot of great promotions. The best and most Ugla of them all is something that the Blue Jays are doing on Saturday, April 11th, and it is called Addison Barger Couch T-Shirt Giveaway. Okay? Now, what does that sentence mean? Addison Barger Couch T-Shirt Giveaway. That's like when Trump said, was it TV woman, radio person? Addison Barger Couch T-Shirt Giveaway. Game one of the World Series. Addison Barger hits a grand slam. The night before, he slept on David Schneider's couch. This was revealed to the public. It was literally me and Jeff Passan and David Schneider and one TV camera. We were like, "What? How great is Addison Barger?" And David Schneider was like, "He slept on my couch last night." And that, like, we were like, "That's amazing." Turned into this whole thing, right? We put the couch itself in the time capsule for the time capsule episode. It was a no-brainer. But what we have here is something that I don't think we had before. And that is a picture of Addison Barger on the couch playing video games on his laptop. He's holding a controller. He kind of looks like John Wick in this picture. A little Keanu Reevesy with the hair beard combo. Only one pillow in the bed. Hilarious. I think I see a Pamplemousse LaCroix on a chair that he's using as a nightstand. This picture is going to be printed on shirts and given out to the first 1,500 fans on entrance on Saturday, April 11th. And that is just so Ugla. So Ugla. Like, when David Schneider took this picture of Addison Barger on his couch, never did he think it would be printed on shirts and given to the first 15,000 fans in attendance.
So this picture was out there. I don't know if this is the first time you've seen this.
First time I've seen this, yeah.
Okay. So I've definitely seen, like, this picture was definitely circulating when the story happened. But I'm just fascinated by the T-shirt design. Like, is it just going to be a white, like, what is this shirt going to look like? Like, are they just, that is the thing that I am most compelled by, because this promotion, the ad on the website does not show a T-shirt. It just shows a picture, this picture, and then it says Addison Barger Couch T-shirt Giveaway. So maybe it's just screen printed. Like how? Oh, here's the other shirt question. This might actually be the number one question about this, because most giveaways are sponsored. Like when they do T-shirt giveaways, like a kitschy jersey or like a
brought
nice
to you by
retro
Game Time,
it's always
or Toyota.
But it's usually like local stuff. Usually it's like, yeah, it's not even the big ads. So is this like, is some random Toronto grocery store going to slap their logo next to this picture of Addison Barger?
Furniture store,
like,
dude.
I don't. Or the hotel that he was staying in, right? Or whatever video game he was playing. I think with the video game or the gaming laptop that he is on here. So a lot of options, but I think that is what I'm most curious about, is the design of the shirt. Is it sponsored? 15,000 fans. It is so Ugla. And a great way to finish off this Friday edition of Baseball Barbacast. Thank you to Ingrid Rosas. Thank you to Andrew Hartz for producing. Thank you to the city of Buffalo for welcoming us and our Sabres fandom. What a time this was. Even though the Sabres lost, we had a great time, and we will definitely be back. Will we be sitting on the glass? Probably not, but we had a great time anyway, and we look forward to cheering on Tage Thompson and Rasmus Dahlin in the Winter Olympics, which begin like right now. I assume the hockey doesn't start like right now. They got to get all those guys over there. But I'm looking forward to watching some more hockey in the coming weeks. And then I'm looking forward to watching the World Baseball Classic. You can email us at baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. We will be back next week. I am off to Arizona next week, but we will have one more show before that on Tuesday. So stay tuned. Thank you all for listening. And we'll talk to you all soon.
Thanks for listening.